today on Against the Grain. When workers want to form a union, what organizing methods do they use, should they use? Do those methods differ for people working in the gig economy? I'm CS. Paul Christopher Gray presents an instructive case study of food couriers in Toronto coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Labor agitation, unionizing efforts, organizing campaigns. We hear about such things. We sometimes read about what workers demand and how employers respond. But we don't hear much about the specifics, the specific methods and tactics used by labor organizers to reach out to coworkers, to mobilize them, to help them understand what's required and what's at stake. Concrete specifics is our focus today. A fascinating case study is the vehicle for gaining insights into the nitty-gritty details of labor organizing. Paul Gray is Assistant Professor of Labor Studies at Brock University in St. Catharines, Canada. He wrote a journal article about an effort by food couriers in Toronto to unionize, an effort that utilized methods like structured organizing conversations, social mapping, social charting, and the identification of leaders and of strategic choke points. The journal Paul's article appeared in is Labor/Le Travail. When Paul Gray and I connected recently, he began with these remarks about the gig economy and gig work.
Well, in the traditional idea of a gig, you have usually a one-time or short-term transaction between someone providing a service and someone paying for it. It's often a supplement to somebody's main source of income, but not always. And prior to 2010, I think the gig was romantically associated with the relationship between a musician and a venue that they had a gig at. Since 2010, however, with the rise of various platform companies like Uber, I think our idea of what a gig is has changed substantially, and it's related more to this idea of the gig economy, and it's related to what we mean by platforms or applications, apps. These are internet-connected software that mediate between different users, often in a transactional relationship. And I think there are three basic kinds of these transactional relationships. The first is selling of non-labor commodities, something you might do on eBay or Kijiji. Then there's renting of non-labor commodities, something you might do on Airbnb. And then there is selling labor as a commodity, something that you might do on Uber, DoorDash, Amazon, Mechanical Turk, and the like. And I think that this last group, selling labor power as a commodity through these platforms, is gig work proper. That's my basic understanding of gig work and how it relates to the gig economy in general.
In this piece, you're writing about couriers who were working for the Foodora platform in the city of Toronto. Tell us a little bit about Foodora and what these couriers did.
Well, Foodora is a subsidiary of a Berlin-based company, Delivery Hero, and essentially customers would download this app and they would order food from restaurants, and then you would have couriers either riding bikes, e-bikes, or driving cars, picking up the food and then delivering it to wherever these customers were.
And these couriers, they would, via this app, furnished by, developed by Foodora, they would know who to deliver to and what to order and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, this is one of the unique things about the gig economy insofar as it's related to these platforms or apps. These platforms are the place where users are recruited, including customers and people who are going to provide their services. It's where they're connected, so you'll have these workers being connected with the customers. It's how that work can be coordinated often. You'll get maps through the app that indicate to, in this case, the courier, where they're going to deliver the food. It's where the courier gets paid. The platform can also engage in various forms of surveillance of gig workers as they're conducting their labor. And it's also the place where these couriers can be disciplined if they're not following the rules as interpreted by these app companies. And disciplines can include being deactivated temporarily or permanently, which basically locks these people out of the app. And it's the equivalent of, in the case of a permanent deactivation, it's the equivalent of being fired from a job.
And so these couriers typically never had in-person contact with their superiors at Foodora?
So Foodora did have a central site where you had executives of the company, the administrators, and you had the dispatchers who were working together with the couriers when they were delivering these goods. And so Foodora couriers could go to this central site and interact with dispatchers and supervisors and the like. And to that extent, I think it has a bit more of a personal relationship with couriers than is often the case in other apps like Uber Eats and the like, tend to be more dependent on algorithms, tends to be more impersonal. But in general, these couriers would rarely see in person any of their supervisors, managers, or the like. And their workplace was the size of a metropolis. There was no central brick or mortar work site for them to go to.
You indicate that these couriers, again working for the Foodora platform, faced many of the challenges common among gig workers. What sorts of challenges do you mean?
Gig workers often face issues of low compensation. The pay can be quite low, and actually providing their work through platforms can be quite expensive when you think about how they have to provide much of their own equipment. You can think about the maintenance costs of owning a car and using it for deliveries, for example, or using it to transport people, having to pay for gas and the like. So this is one issue that gig workers face. Another, one that is quite relevant to couriers, is health and safety issues. This can be incredibly dangerous work. People have been injured and in the rare circumstances have died doing this kind of work. And often, because of the way in which the gig economy is structured, the health and safety concerns are exacerbated because these employers are not liable for accidents that occur in the workplace. And that's connected with one of the other major barriers that gig workers tend to face. And that is that whenever someone employs another to provide work of one kind or another, they have to submit a kind of legal classification of what kind of work is being provided. And the two major categories are employee and independent contractor. The idea of an employee is someone who is dependent on the person to whom they're providing their labor for the workplace. There's a deep and integral connection between the work that person is providing to this particular employer and the way in which this employer is gaining profits from the labor that's being provided. Whereas an independent contractor is associated with someone who has much more flexibility, much more autonomy. They own much more of their equipment, much more choice in with whom they can engage in these kinds of transactions. And what has happened is a lot of these gig companies, basically all of them typically, will classify gig workers not as employees, but as independent contractors. And independent contractors often do not have the same kinds of labor rights and protections that people who are classified as employees have. So, for example, independent contractors don't have certain minimum labor standards like a minimum wage, and they don't have certain minimum rights associated with being an employee, like, for example, the right to form a union, to engage in collective bargaining, and to strike.
You also write that the work done by these couriers was unpredictable and had high turnover. So this is a fairly common aspect of the gig economy.
Yes, I think that gig work is a form of work that is similar to a much broader category of work, and that is casual labor or contingent labor, where it occurs on a kind of one-off or short-term basis, where you might be working part-time for multiple different employers. It's unpredictable in terms of, you know, when you're going to be scheduled, when you can expect to be able to work. It demands much more flexibility of you and your time while you're working. And I think that the gig economy is part of a broader trend, the kind of neoliberal transformation of work that's been occurring since the 1970s towards these much more casual, precarious forms of work.
In May 2018, 8 Foodora couriers met in a park. What did they discuss, and what was the outcome of this meeting?
Well, on that night in Christie Pitts Park in Toronto, these 8 couriers, who did not have much experience with labor organizing, discussed how the work for Foodora was transforming and declining over time. The way in which their, you know, wages, what they're making for delivering this food, you know, was declining. The structure of the scheduling was becoming more rigid. So even though one of the attractive features of this work was the flexibility it was supposed to guarantee, it felt like it was becoming more and more inflexible. And they felt basically that they lacked dignity in the workplace insofar as they were being classified, misclassified as they would say, as independent contractors rather than employees. And so after that discussion, they found that they shared the same issues and they made a commitment to work together to try and engage in workplace organizing. And they wanted to initiate a campaign to try to unionize. And that would mean that they would have to legally challenge their misclassification as independent contractors in order to gain the rights that employees have. That includes the right to unionize. And they knew that it was going to be incredibly difficult. For example, how do you persuade a majority of your coworkers to join something like a union when your workplace is the size of a metropolis and you don't know how many coworkers you have, let alone who they are? Despite these challenges, they committed to the project, they committed to trying to work through it and try to understand how they might engage in workplace organizing in this very peculiar workplace.
Paul Gray is my guest. He is Assistant Professor of Labor Studies at Brock University in St. Catharines, Canada. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So these couriers who launched the workplace organizing campaign that would become known as Foodsters United, they learned the importance early on of one-on-one organizing conversations. What are organizing conversations?
Yeah, that's a crucial one. Early on, they reached out to some couriers who were part of the Industrial Workers of the World, and a few of the members of that organization provided some basic labor organizing skills, a kind of workshop on how to organize your workplace. And, you know, the Wobblies, another name for the Industrial Workers of the World, actually had some members who were working for this and other app companies in this context. And so all of them were kind of interested, how can you apply these traditional organizing techniques to some of the new peculiar features of the gig economy. And one of the things that they teach you in traditional labor organizing is that you have to always prioritize the one-on-one in-person conversation. You know, you can see why in contemporary context, especially in this context, people might turn to something like social media as a way to try to reach people, especially when you think of all the barriers that these gig workers were confronting and trying to find out who their coworkers were and to reach all of them. And early on, they experimented with this, but they found that there were significant limits to engaging in that kind of outreach through social media. You might have 100 people on a particular chat group, but only 5 to 10 people participating. Less than half of the people actually show up to events that they commit to on these apps. And so they found that they were going to have to go through the slow, methodical process of identifying who all their coworkers were and trying to find them and have these one-on-one conversations. And one of the reasons why that's so important is that an organizing conversation is highly structured. There is a right way to do it in the kind of organizing tradition. And there are, you know, different acronyms, but the one that I think is most familiar, the way in which to have this structured organizing conversation is AEIOU. That is, you agitate, educate, inoculate, organize, unionize. And these represent different steps in how to have this organizing conversation.
Yeah, let's talk about this AEIOU model. So how did each component of this model, again, agitate, educate, inoculate, organize, and unionize, manifest and unfold?
So the first part of the organizing conversation is agitate. And typically what they teach a new organizer is that when you're having these conversations, you should always listen much more than you speak. You've got two ears and one mouth, and generally that's the right ratio of speaking to listening that an organizer should follow. You should be asking a lot of open-ended questions rather than yes-no questions. You should be asking folks about how they feel about their working conditions, what some of their problems about their working conditions might be, some of the issues that they might have. And the reason it's called agitation is that, you know, as people are given space to reflect on their working conditions and to talk about them, they realize that actually there's often a lot of problems with their workplace, that they do have a lot of issues that they care about. And this helps you down the road in understanding what their main issues are and trying to get a commitment to the kind of collective activity that's often necessary to be able to address some of these issues that folks might have. The second part is education, and that generally is the idea of laying the blame, saying that the reason why these working conditions have these problems is not because of some immutable aspect of working conditions in all times and places, but because of decisions made by people who have power, people who could be persuaded otherwise if there is some collective organizing that is able to issue demands to those people who had the power to make these conditions and have the power to transform them. The inoculate phase of an organizing conversation is named that because it shares some similarities with what we typically associate with the idea of inoculation, that is getting a small dose of something so that you can build up the antibodies so that when you're exposed to the real thing later on, it's not as harmful. So typically in an organizing conversation, you will ask people that you're speaking to, you know, well, what if management says this? Or, you know, what if an unsympathetic coworker argues this? And you explore how you might respond to these kinds of counterarguments or criticisms so that when these folks encounter them later on from management, for example, there's already been a substantial amount of workshopping around them so that people know how to respond. It's not as scary when they encounter it because they haven't encountered it for the first time. And one of the things that these Fedora couriers really focused on is they thought that Fedora would argue that if a union was introduced into this kind of workplace, that it would create rigid structures, it would really hem in people's flexibility, it would turn the job into a standard 9-to-5. And this could be an effective counter-argument, because the reason why a lot of these folks were doing this kind of work is because they didn't want a 9-to-5. You know, maybe they had childcare responsibilities, and so they valued being able to log into the app when they had the time to do so and to work for it for the time that they had and the like. And so these couriers would ask folks, how would you respond to a criticism like that, and hear what people had to say. And they might also suggest themselves that actually Fedora is the one that is introducing these new, more rigid scheduling structures. They're the ones who are kind of clamping down on the flexibility that they had promised as, you know, part of their push to get people to join this app, if we're able to form a group that can represent our collective interests, we can actually advocate in favor of maintaining that kind of flexibility around scheduling. Actually, the union is the solution to this, not the problem. And then you switch to O, or organizing, and that is basically trying to persuade folks that they have issues that they care about, there's someone to blame, and that these can be fixed, but only if people organize together and use the strength and numbers that they have, the leverage that can arise from that, in order to create that change. And this part of the organizing conversation often entails getting a commitment, having a task, whether it's attending a meeting or doing something like getting a certain number of coworkers to sign a petition or something like that. You ask folks to join the organizing effort, to join the collectivity by assigning a specific task so everyone is clear the level of commitment that's being asked and what the concrete task is, such that you know whether or not it's been completed, so you can assess how committed the person is to the collective organizing. And on that basis, you turn to the last phase of the organizing conversation, which is unionize, and that is essentially, you know, trying to make the argument that the traditional and standard collective organization of workers under capitalism is the union, and that we need a union to be able to address all of these issues that we have in our workplace.
That's the voice of Paul Gray. He teaches in the Department of Labor Studies at Brock University in St. Catharines, Ontario. He's editor of the volume From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power. And we are talking about an article he wrote about organizing gig workers in Toronto, specifically the campaign put forward by Foodsters United against the app company Foodora. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Well, in order to have these all-important organizing conversations, they had to find their coworkers. They had to seek out and locate these people so they could have these conversations with them. And to that end, social mapping became very important, and it's an important part, as you write, of workplace organizing generally. What is social mapping?
Social mapping is a long-established organizing technique where workers are asked to physically draw up maps of their workplace so that they can start to think about them strategically. So on large pieces of paper, poster board, or the like, you try to draw and map out your workplace and then start to identify some strategically relevant aspects of that workplace. One thing that you typically do in social mapping is you try to map out all of the lines of movement, all of the different parts of the labor process, you know, what people are doing what, how they're moving from one station or phase of production to another, who they might interact with in the process of engaging in this work. And this helps you to start to think strategically about how you might use some of these lines of movement in your organizing. For example, you may notice in the workplace that there are bottlenecks That is to say that you have a lot of people in a relatively small space, or you have one phase of the production process that is so connected to the others that it is, you know, one of the most crucial or the most crucial parts of the production process. And this kind of thinking is important because it might be a way to establish what's referred to as choke points. These are parts of the production process where if you focused your efforts, you could increase the disruptive capacity of your activities.
Indeed, and on the question of choke points, which choke points did the foodsters identify? Which locations do they see as particularly strategic in relation to their goal of finding coworkers, talking with them, and trying to get them to sign union cards?
So basically, they mapped out their workplace and they started by trying to identify key intersections where they might better focus their activities. And so one of the bottlenecks that they identified was Spadina and Richmond. This is a significant intersection in downtown Toronto. It's got four restaurants, one on each corner, that are popular amongst the users of various food apps. It's got bike lanes in either direction. And the traffic lights, this is important, last 45 seconds instead of the standard 30 seconds, which gives folks more opportunity to have a longer organizing conversation with people as they're biking by or they've come to a stop at the intersection. And so one of the things that they did is they mapped out key intersections like this, and then they set up these kind of welcome tents. And any time that they noticed one of their coworkers driving towards this intersection, they tried to flag them down. And they found that they were having a lot of success with this, that they were encountering many more couriers than they would have otherwise, because they had identified these kinds of bottlenecks and were using them as these kinds of choke points to be able to have this structured organizing conversation with all of these different couriers going through.
Now, given that they might have only very limited amount of time to interact with these coworkers on the street or stopped at a stoplight, what do they do in order to make further conversation possible, such that they could do a lot of listening, such that they could go through many of these AEIOU components with the person, with their interlocutor?
So I think that they developed two basic strategies. The first is what they called the stoplight conversation. This is what they called it. And it was a kind of preliminary organizing conversation that was meant to set up the more structured organizing conversation later. It was the kind of thing that was supposed to be conducted in 10 seconds or less while people were waiting at intersections. And they try to engage in as much agitation as possible. You know, they'd ask people, how's your shift going? They might say, you know, really tough shift for me. You know, not getting a lot of orders. How about you? Allow this person to express themselves and then say, listen, a few of us are getting together later on to discuss the working conditions here. Can I get your contact info? I'll let you know where we're meeting. That was one thing. The other thing was the ride-along conversation. And so essentially these organizers would ask couriers if they could ride with them while they're making their deliveries. Just to talk to them about their experiences and to share some experiences in the workplace. And this was a way to have a longer organizing conversation. And they found, actually, to their surprise, that much more than the bike couriers, they had a lot of success in the ride-along conversations with car couriers, because one of the unique issues faced by car couriers is parking tickets. You're trying to make these deliveries, you got to get out of your car. There's not a lot of parking spots in Toronto. And if you have someone sitting in the passenger seat, it means the car is not parked, you're not going to get a ticket. And so actually people were welcoming these coworkers into the passenger seat to do the kind of ride-along conversation, because it meant that they could make their delivery without the risk of parking tickets.
One of what you call their most inspired strategies, and again, this is a group called Foodsters United in Toronto, involved foodsters ordering food from Foodora. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this one I loved. I thought that this was strategically ingenious. What the foodsters were finding is that they were having a bunch of good organizing conversations with folks in the downtown core. But in the outer realms where Fedora was doing deliveries, the exurbs, the suburbs, especially those areas where there are more car couriers than there are bike couriers, they were having a hard time reaching these folks. And they decided, okay, rather than us going to them, let's try to bring them to us. So they would go to places, say in North York, and they would order food from Fedora, and the courier that showed up to make the delivery, they would have the organizing conversation with them. And depending on how well that organizing conversation went, they would start to try to train these folks in having similar organizing conversations with some of the coworkers that they knew in that area. And eventually, they mobilized a bunch of allies in the broader labor movement to do, you know, what they called call-in days. And that was basically having dozens, sometimes hundreds of people ordering food from Fedora. And these people had been trained in having a mini preliminary organizing conversation where basically someone would show up to deliver food. These folks would hand to them a package of materials from the Foodsters United Union campaign and contact info so that these couriers could reach out to the organizers of the campaign if they wanted to follow up with it. So I thought this was one of the more inspired strategies that they came up with.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Paul Christopher Gray, Assistant Professor of Labor Studies at Brock University in Ontario, Canada, joins me. He wrote a really interesting article about organizing gig workers in Toronto with Foodsters United. It appeared in the fall 2022 issue of the journal Labor/Le Travail. There is much more in your article about social mapping and choke points, but I want to move on to another classic workplace organizing method, and that is social charting. What is social charting?
Social charting is a traditional labor organizing technique where you literally draft up charts of information about coworkers. You are trying to meet folks and get an understanding of who they are and assess the relationship to their work, to each other, and to your campaign in the sense of, are they supportive of the campaign? Are they willing to join it? Are they indifferent? Are they hostile? And so typically what a social chart will include is a coworker's name and then some basic information about the shifts that they work, where they work, the kind of work that they do. You might have some basic information in terms of how to contact them, a phone number, an email, and the like. If you've had these structured organizing conversations with them, you can include things like what are some of the issues, the main issues, what's their biggest issue with the workplace, the kind of thing that they're most concerned about. You can also assess the level of commitment to the campaign by charting what tasks have people been asked to do and to what extent have they been fulfilled. And I thought that they applied this traditional technique to their gig economy workplace in some really ingenious ways.
Such as?
So let's take a step back and look at some of the challenges that these folks had trying to organize this workplace. They were classified as independent contractors. That means that by law, they could not unionize. So what they were going to do is they were going to legally challenge this as a misclassification, try to get it overturned, and try to win the classification of the employee who has the right to form a union. That was the first thing. If they were able to successfully challenge this misclassification, if they were considered some form of employee that was legally allowed and entitled to the right to unionize, then it raised the question of who would be considered an active worker. Now, in a traditional workplace, let's say a factory, if you try to unionize it, it's fairly clear who is going to be in the bargaining unit. The people who are doing similar kinds of work on the shop floor. But in the gig economy, this is much less straightforward. There's a question of, okay, even if you do win the right to unionize, who is going to be considered part of a potential bargaining unit? You can think of it in these terms. Would it be everyone who had signed up for the app, even if they had never worked a shift? Or would it be everyone who signed up for the app, but had only worked one shift? Or would it be everyone who had signed up for the app but worked a shift within a certain amount of time, say within the year that these folks tried to apply to gain a union? Would it be within 6 months of that, 1 month of that? So this kind of thing would have to be determined by the labor board, in this case, the Ontario Labor Relations Board, who would be considered an active worker. One of the reasons why this is significant is you have to demonstrate that the majority of people want to form a union in order to get a union. In Ontario, there's a two-step process. First, you have to get a certain percentage of the workforce that would be in the union to sign union cards demonstrating their support for forming a union. In Ontario, it's 40%. If you get that 40%, you submit the application to the labor board, they count the cards. If they've determined that you have 40% or more of the prospective workforce signing these cards, then they have a union vote. And in the union vote, it has to be 50% plus one of all of the people who would be in the prospective bargaining unit. 50% plus one of them have to vote, a majority, simple majority, have to vote in favor of it for the union to then become recognized in a mandatory way by the employer and by the government.
But to get to the 40% threshold, the list of overall employees, total employees, had to be figured out. And as you were saying, Foodsters United had to do some guessing because they didn't know what the Ontario Labor Relations Board would determine would be the criteria for calculating the number of active employees, such that 40% of them had to sign union cards to get this process going. And there was something Foodora was doing that made it more difficult, probably intentionally, for the workers to figure out who was actually an active worker. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So a traditional issue that workers face when applying to unionize is sometimes their employer will do what's called stacking the list. So if a group of workers have applied to unionize, usually the labor board will then insist on the company providing a list of all of the employees that would potentially be in the bargaining unit, you know, potentially be a part of this union if it is successfully formed. But what employers sometimes do is they stack the list, which means they put names on the employee list that don't actually belong there. Names of people who would not be in the future union if it formed. So maybe they include managers' names on the list, or maybe people who have already retired. And the reason why employers would do this is the more names that you add to the list, the longer the list becomes, the higher the number of people you have to get to sign union cards in order to reach that 40% threshold. And there are very few repercussions for employers trying to stack the list, and so sometimes they do it. And it's then the responsibility of the workers who are trying to unionize to go through the list and to identify all of those who don't belong on it and try to get the labor board to cross them off the list so that there's a more accurate understanding of what the total number of employees is and what 40% actually means. That's a longstanding issue for workers. It is especially difficult for workers in the gig economy because of how contingent this labor is, how easy it is to sign up people to an app, and how open-ended the question of what an active worker is in this context. And so these workers in Foodsters United were quite wary of the possibilities of their company, of Foodora, trying to stack the list. And so one of the things that these folks introduced into their social charting is what they called a deactivated list. Any worker who had been deactivated from the app, you know, through their various organizing conversations and following up with folks, if they found that people hadn't worked a shift in a long time, if they planned on moving away, or, you know, they were going to stop working for Fedora, or if they had been deactivated, they put all of those people into a separate list that they called the deactivated list, because they thought that this list would be some of the prime candidates that Fedora would attempt to include on a kind of stacked list.
Paul Gray joins us on Against the Grain. I'm C.S. Song. He teaches in the Department of Labor Studies at Brock University in St. Catharines, Canada. There's so much more in your article. You write about the phone banking card signing blitz launched by Foodsters United in July 2019, and about Fedora's response, its sort of counterattack, by doing a massive hiring spree, raising the number of employees, making it harder to reach the 40% threshold. But to continue with the theme of organizing methods, another key method is leadership identification. How would you define it?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about leadership identification, but I just wanted to point to one thing. You mentioned this hiring spree, and this was, you know, a really interesting case of attack and counterattack between the Foodsters United and Fedora deploying various strategies. And we mentioned before the idea of choke points. Well, as soon as this hiring spree kind of emerged, these workers came up with a new choke point. They knew that there was this central office where all of these new people being hired by the app were going to have to go through their new worker orientation, their onboarding. And so basically what the Foodsters did was they decided to post up at all of the entrances and exits of this central office of Fedora in Toronto. And anyone they saw walking in that they didn't recognize, that they suspected was a new courier, they did organizing conversations right then and there. And anyone that they saw walking out, who they may have missed on their way in, they did the organizing conversations. And they got a bunch of people to sign the cards right then and there, often before they had even gone in to do their new worker orientation. So I think that's a pretty good example of a choke point. In terms of what you asked about leadership identification, this is another crucial feature of traditional labor organizing methods. Essentially, there's an idea that when you're organizing, you have to remember you're never starting from scratch, that workers are already organized in a variety of ways in informal groups. There might be the people who carpool together, who smoke together, they might be part of the same migrant community and the like. And so trying to identify in your mapping and charting these pre-existing informal groups is a crucial feature of labor organizing. Another aspect of that is trying to identify who the natural or organic leaders are within the workforce. The point of this is that it leads to more efficient organizing. You as an organizer can try to speak to, let's say, all 1,000 coworkers. Or if you're able to identify some of the already existing groups, you can speak to one person, train them into having a kind of organizing conversation, which they can then conduct with the people of their group, and often more persuasively than you can. And that's a much more efficient way of doing it. It actually spreads the skills around. It's more democratic. And this is related to the idea of identifying leaders. There are some people who are natural or organic leaders in every context. And it's rarely the people who speak first, the people who speak most, or the people who speak the loudest. Often, it's the people who, when they do speak, others listen. And actually, they're less likely to speak first, often, or loudest, because they know that there are greater stakes in what they have to say, because people will actually listen to them and take what they have to say seriously. And so part of leadership identification is trying to figure out what are some of the qualities of these natural or organic leaders in a workplace context. It's often the folks who are quite good at their jobs. It's often the folks who, you know, if you as a worker have a question that you're really embarrassed to ask anyone else, you would ask this person. There's a level of trust there. And part of you know, organizing is trying to identify who these leaders are, because if you can have an organizing conversation with them, you can persuade them using this structured organizing conversation to engage in organizing and unionizing, then they can often speak to their coworkers, their constituents, the people who listen to them above all. You know, they can have the kind of organizing conversations much better than you would be able to have it. And this is something that Foodsters United tried to introduce into their campaign. They tried to engage in this leadership identification.
In the interest of time, I want to jump ahead to what happened in 2020, soon after the COVID pandemic hit. The Ontario Labour Relations Board issued rulings on the status of the Foodora couriers and on the question of whether Foodsters United had gathered enough signed union cards, whether it had met the 40% threshold. What did the Labour Board decide?
Yeah, so the early phases of the pandemic is a crucial period in this union campaign. The first thing that happened was essentially that the Ontario Labour Relations Board ruled that these workers had been misclassified, that they were not independent contractors, that they were dependent contractors, which is a form of employee, which means that they had the right to unionize. So now that they did have the right to unionize, they would be allowed to vote for a union. Those votes would be sealed. They would then have all of the cards that Foodsters United had collected to see if they met the 40% threshold. If they did meet that 40% threshold, then they would open up the votes and see if the majority had voted in favor of the union. And so the union vote proceeded. Those ballots were sealed. And then there was a question of who the Labour Board would regard as an active worker. And so when the Labour Board decided that anyone who had worked a shift within 4 months of the union application would be considered an active worker, they then counted all of the relevant cards for everyone who had worked within those 4 months. And somehow, against seemingly insurmountable odds, Foodsters United reached and exceeded that 40% threshold. Then they opened the ballots that the Labour Board had been holding from the union vote. And when they counted them, they found that 88.8% of the people who voted had voted in favor of forming a union, a massive number. So this was a major success for these gig workers. It showed a kind of model for how gig workers can apply traditional organizing techniques to their the peculiarities of the gig economy workplace. Nevertheless, this success was tempered by a devastating setback. Soon after the Labour Board had ruled that these couriers are a form of employee that is, you know, that's allowed to form unions, Foodora declared bankruptcy and withdrew all of its operations from Canada. This was essentially what occurred in these early phases of the COVID-19 pandemic. So some major victories and then a huge defeat. And it was on that basis that the organizers of Foodsters United decided to transition in the midst of the pandemic to Gig Workers United. Rather than trying to organize gig workers at one or another company, they decided that they would try a kind of community unionism model where they would organize gig workers across Toronto, whatever their form of work and whatever companies that they were working for. And Gig Workers United exists to this day and is trying to organize the efforts of gig workers in Toronto.
What do you find most impressive about what Foodsters United was able to do? And what's the lesson here? What do you see as what we can take from the steps and methods and efforts that these folks performed and achieved and did over a period of many, many months?
I think one of the things that we often hear from the platform companies themselves is that the gig economy is totally unprecedented. It is something new. It's the future of work. And I think that actually the gig economy, despite what's new about it, has a lot of parallels with prior eras in the history of capitalism. And to the extent that gig workers agree with this idea of the unprecedented character of the gig economy, that might mean that they might neglect some of the organizing traditions that have been crafted over centuries when they engage in some of their own workplace organizing, and I think that this would be a mistake. I think one of the things that Foodsters United and now Gig Workers United demonstrates is that you can apply some of these traditional organizing methods to the peculiar workplace that you find in the gig economy, even if your workplace is a metropolis, even if you don't know how many coworkers you have when you begin, let alone who those coworkers are. We've spoken about some traditional organizing techniques like leadership identification, issue identification. I think one of the most impressive things that these folks did is what you could call coworker identification. They use these traditional methods, social mapping, social charting, to map out their workplace. And I think one of the major success stories of Foodsters United, despite this devastating setback, I think one of the things that makes it a model that other gig workers could learn from is that they were able to have one-on-one, in-person conversations with so many of their coworkers dispersed over so broad a workplace that they were able to get more than 40% of those coworkers to agree to form a union and to sign those union cards.
Paul Gray, assistant professor in the Department of Labor Studies at Brock University in St. Catharines, Canada, editor of the volume From the Streets to the State, Changing the World by Taking Power, published by SUNY Press. We've been talking about an article he wrote that appeared in the journal Labor Le Travail. It's called The Same Tools Work Everywhere, Organizing Gig Workers with Foodsters United. Paul, thanks so much for your work and for writing this article and for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.